Wow, the August primary is less than 3 weeks away, and after taking full control of the legislature last year, Democrats want to grow that slim majority in both the House and the Senate. KyroRadio's Hannah Scott is here with a look at some of the key races and top priorities for Democrats. We'll do the Republicans tomorrow, but for now, the Democrats have.
So for the first time in several years, Democrats took control of the Senate this past session with Democrat Monka Dingra's win in the 45th District last year to flip the seat of late Republican Senator Andy Hill. And while that did help get some key Democratic priorities on things like voting rights passed through the legislature this past session, that one-seat majority in the Senate, Democrats holding their two-seat majority in the House, and having a Democrat in the governor's office was still not enough to get some of the other Democratic priorities in the short session passed on things like gun control, a carbon tax, abolishing the death penalty. So the goal in November is to widen the majority in both of those chambers. 25 of the 49 seats in the state Senate are up for election in November. State Senator and Washington State Democratic Campaign Chair Jamie Peterson says they're very focused, though, on a handful of those races. First, there's the three swing districts where they're going to be defending seats currently held by Democrats. On the east side, they're focused on Monka Dingra holding onto that seat, winning a full term in the 45th, and Senator Steve Hobbs up in Snohomish County holding onto his seat in the 44th. Democrats are pretty confident in those two races, but Senator Peterson says the race in the 48th is expected to be a bit more of an issue.
Where Senator Patty Cooterer is being challenged by Rodney Tom, who was the leader of the Republican caucus. He's now running, I think, very deceptively as a Democrat, even though he has no plans to caucus with the Democrats. So, and that, I think, is a very cynical move because the polling indicates quite clearly that a Republican could not possibly win in the 48th legislative district.
So a little background there on Rodney Tom. He was in the House, state House for several years as a Republican. He then switched parties and was elected to the state Senate as a Democrat in 2010. But then in 2012, he started caucusing with the Republicans, kind of giving them that majority, along with, I believe, Tim Sheldon. Right. So that's kind of the issue there. So Peterson says they're going to focus on that campaign, really kind of educating, as he put it, voters on who the real Democrat is in that race.
And then he left the legislature for a while?
He did. I'm sorry. He left in 2014 for his health and then now is running back in the seat that he used to hold.
Okay.
Democrats are also looking to grab four seats in the Senate currently held by Republicans where they think they've got a pretty good chance. And that includes the 30th District where Democratic Claire Wilson, a member of the Federal Way School Board, is going to be trying to unseat Republican Mark Malosha.
Who also used to be a Democrat.
Yes, as Deb Peterson pointed out. Right. So a lot about educating voters in this one. They're also trying to take the seat in the 26th. That's the Kitsap Peninsula. That's open because Republican Jan Angel's retirement, which was a bit unexpected. And they've got a Democrat taking on Republican Senator Joe Fain in the 47th. That's the Kent Auburn area that they're feeling pretty confident about. Now, one that's supposed to get pretty heated. They're also looking to snatch the Republican seat in the 42nd, and that's North Whatcom County, Bellingham area, where they've got two Democrats right now in the race against Republican Doug Erickson.
Doug Erickson's one of President Trump's prime supporters in Washington State, worked for his Environmental Protection Agency. That's going to be a hotly contested race, regardless of which of our candidates winds up winning.
So Doug Erickson, of course, when he had that gig at the EPA, took a lot of heat from some of his people for he missed some committee meetings in the legislature and got a lot of heat for that. So they're feeling like they have a good chance at getting that seat. All four of those districts, by the way, that they're looking to grab from Republicans were won by Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. So that's the other reason they're feeling good about it. Peterson says they've also got some of the most diverse candidates ever in all seven of these races, with all of the candidates being either women, people of color, or both, and two of them are lesbians.
We have never had a lesbian elected to the Washington State Senate. All of the Democratic candidates would move the Senate toward being more diverse and more representative of the diverse population of the state of Washington.
Now, as far as plans in the House, they have a similar story where they're trying to defend a couple of seats and then also grab some new stuff from Republicans, according to State Representative Joe Fitzgibbons.
Well, we have a lot of races where we think that there's a really good chance for a Democrat to get elected in seats that Republicans currently hold. First of all, there's a lot of Republican House members who are retiring this year. And whenever there's an open seat, we have a better opportunity in that seat to pick it up when there's no incumbent running.
There's more than a dozen races that they're pretty focused on. I'll have more on those in the 8 o'clock hour when we talk about it. And Fitzgibbon says that they also have a really diverse field of candidates like they have in the Senate in their races. Again, a lot of women. They've got younger candidates. I believe one is 27 years old. So a lot of that going on. Some of the big issues that I asked them, both of them, what they thought they may have to defend against in this upcoming campaign season. Of course, they always say taxes. Fitzgibbon said that this is that is not something that is going to be on the agenda in the upcoming
session. No income tax on the agenda?
No. Something that they are priorities, again, that they want to focus on, especially in the Senate, is even if I-1639, the initiative, the gun control initiative that is going to likely be on the ballot, passes, he says there's more work to be done on that in the state legislature. That'll be a big, big focus for them going in next year. And even on a carbon tax, again, where we've got an initiative, even should that carbon fee, 1631 pass, he says there's more work that needs to be done on that as well.
In terms of campaign tactics, are they going to do the local candidate morphing into an image of Donald Trump thing against the Republicans?
No, and you know what? I actually asked both of them that about the national kind of state of things, and they're really focused on local issues, both in the state Senate races and the state House races, which, again, include a lot of things. Gun control is going to be a big part of this. Property tax, pet taxes that, you know, Republicans say it's the Democrats' fault that we have that property tax and then vice versa. So I expect that to be a really big deal in the campaign moving forward. And they're going to have to answer for some things. The public records debacle that happened in the legislature last year, that bill is definitely something Fitzgibbon told me that he expects that all...
Where they uniquely exempted themselves.
Yes. And then backed records. And had to back away from that bill, but they're going to have to, people who voted for that, lawmakers who voted for that and are in races this year, are going to likely have to defend against that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Let's talk about the housing market. Everybody seems to be upset about housing. It's not just homelessness. It's, of course, the price of housing and where the new housing will go and how big it will be and what it will look like. And nobody's happy except people with an expensive piece of property to sell. Let's get another perspective, this time from Congressman Denny Heck, who represents Washington's 10th District. That's parts of Pierce, Thurston, and Mason counties. He is a member of what's called the New Democratic Coalition. This is a group of 68 Democrats who are coming together in what you might consider more business-friendly ways to solve problems like housing affordability. He chairs the Housing Task Force, which just issued a report detailing the causes of the housing crisis, not just here, but all over the country. And the conclusion of the report is that, this will bowl you over, there are simply not enough housing units of all kinds to meet the demand, and that we are millions of units short across the nation. And this is something we hear from YIMBYs, and YIMBY means yes in my backyard, and urbanists quite often. The only way to fix the skyrocketing rents and skyrocketing home prices is to build our way out of the problem. Unleash the developers. Let them create an oversupply. Because when that happens, prices start going down. So I asked Representative Heck to explain where he stands on this.
I think the point that more housing construction of all kinds is needed to help solve the homelessness problem is at this point inarguable. We need more housing of all kinds for all neighbors. The fact is that on a nationwide basis, there's no nationwide housing market. But there's a nationwide housing crisis, Dave. And on a national basis, we're about 7 million units short of legitimate demand. And what that causes is for prices to escalate at a faster pace than people can afford. So they get locked into their home. They can't move up. If they can't move up, people can't move into their homes. We're not building enough starter homes. We have more people renting because they can't buy the starter homes. So rent occupancies go up, and along with it go rental rates. When more people become rent burdened, then more people become publicly subsidized. And when more people become publicly subsidized, more people become homeless. It's an ecosystem, Dave. Yeah. And what we need to do is build a whole lot more housing units in this country, more homes of all kinds for all neighbors. And we won't solve the homelessness issue if the fact of the matter is we haven't dealt with the housing market as a whole.
Okay, so what's Congress's role there? That's usually a local thing. What does Congress have to do with that?
The federal government plays an enormous role in the provision of housing, from the mortgage interest deduction to a plethora of programs in the Department of Housing and Urban Development to help people who are rent burdened and to help the homeless. There is a strong partnership role for the federal government to be played. Let me give you an example of what I think that we ought to be a whole lot more serious about. The federal government throughout the nation is investing hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in the construction of mass transit through grants to state and local governments. And when they do that, that property is purchased on which to build the track. The fact of the matter is we could be doing a whole lot better job creating denser housing along transit pathways in order not only to improve environmental effects of increased density, but also to provide housing units that people desperately seek in this environment. After all, we're talking about a Seattle market in which we're cooling a tad bit, but the fact of the matter is the day of listing, everybody's going to get multiple offers, and the bidding starts at the asking price. Right. That's not sustainable. No. And if you don't think that we will make progress on homelessness unless we deal with that, well, we have to deal with it as an ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that you build transit, and it makes the land more valuable. And developers come in, they want to demolish the old homes and build apartment buildings near the rail station, which makes sense. But then people say, but that's gentrification. The neighborhood's changing. You're chasing the old residents out. That's not fair.
What's the alternative, Dave? your kids can't ever afford to buy a home in
that's right.
Seattle. Went to Gonzaga, go Gonzaga,
that's
comes
right.
home. And
well, I made that argument to, you know, to a housing advocate. And the pushback is that that, again, it's always the poor who get poorer and the rich who get richer. So give me your argument. If you were at a community meeting in South Seattle, for example, where some of this is going on, what would you tell people who would say, oh, there you go again, moving out the poor people for the sake of the middle class or the upper class?
I don't think you build transit-oriented development just for middle income or upper income. I think you have to, again, consider it holistically, and you have to make provision for low-income folks. You have to make provision for people who need rent support, and you have to make provision for the homelessness that are obviously a serious issue. I would tell people in South Seattle that they have every reason to and every right to bring forth their concerns about what increased development means in their neighborhood. But I would also say to them, what is your alternative? Do you want your children to ever be able to own a home here? And if we are not providing for more housing units to meet the demand that is there, because this issue fundamentally is characterized by demand is far greater than supply, then does that mean that you want us just to continue to sprawl? And we all know and understand what the environmental impacts of increased sprawl. We have to get to a point here where we can have win-win, both for our environment and for our communities and for livability. But the fact of the matter is, housing is a fundamental need of the human race, and we have to provide for them as a nation in some fashion, and we aren't. We are 7 million plus units short.
Congressman Denny Heck, 10th Congressional District. Time for a Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here is Danny O'Neill. We have our annual peek behind the NFL's financial curtain, courtesy of the Green Bay Packers. Explain how this works, Danny.
The Packers report?
Yeah.
The Packers are publicly owned. They're the only team in the country in the major professional sports that can't be moved.
That's the only reason we get to see these figures.
Yeah. So it's,
how did that work?
Well, it belongs to the community. There's
why
never
was that?
Been. I'm not sure when it started back when it was a mill town and they sold it. But it's been a community-owned team, so people can buy shares in it. It is, people have them as souvenirs. Some people have them as, they have an operating officer. And
is that a good model?
He's in effect charging.
It's to prevent the team from being moved, I think, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, I'm not sure if it was a defense maneuver or where it happened along the way in history. I'll have to do a report and get back to you on that.
I mean, aren't they the smallest town?
Yes, by far.
NFL
it's
team,
100,000 population.
Yeah, so, I think, but for that, they might have moved a long time ago.
That's very possibly true. Or maybe the reason that they never moved was because they were always community-owned. And that they always had. Is it a good model? You'd have to convince a lot of billionaires to give up properties. I mean, an NFL team now is worth $2 billion. So they would have to give it to the community. And I don't think those guys are in the business of giving things away. There are downsides to it. But in a salary-capped league like the NFL is, it's worked really, really well.
Yeah. So we get that means we have to look at the books. And what do the books tell us? Because we can multiply this by how many teams are there?
32.
32. You multiply by 32, that shows you how much revenue they're getting?
Yes. And that will show you the national TV. There's a big pot of football revenue that goes to all teams. Yeah. And according to the share the Packers got of that, the total pot was $8
billion. $8 billion.
And that was up 5% from last year. So the total pot of money that was divided, and a lot of that comes from the national TV contracts and the regulated increases on that according to the contracts, the increase of 5%. Everything's being contrasted, both the studies of the TV ratings for the NFL last year, which TV ratings were down, but they weren't down as much as overall TV watching was. So essentially, while TV viewing of the NFL declined, it didn't decline as much as TV viewing overall did.
Got it.
So you would say that there's little evidence that people have consciously turned off.
So this whole anthem thing is bogus.
That's how it's being posited. Yeah. I don't know if you can take a one-year window and conclude that, especially when the majority of the money comes from a TV deal. That there was no TV networks didn't have an option about paying less.
I just have a hard time believing that somebody, because I've heard it. People have texted us saying, that's it. I'm done with the NFL. No more. I have a hard time believing that somebody who has likely watched sports, participated in sports from the very first memory they can form about sports would just give up sports cold turkey.
That's why most sports reporters, when they write about this, say examples, mostly anecdotal, because you're looking for evidence that there has been an actual boycott or an actual turnoff of the TV.
I think it's just a tough guy thing to say.
And we haven't seen it yet. It doesn't mean it's not coming, and it doesn't mean that the game doesn't have problems, because there's two fronts that it has problems. It's definitely got a public health perception problem about the safety of the game, and then you also have the political nature of the protests that have happened and the reaction to those specifically from our president. But so far, there's no indication that TV viewership has been disproportionately down or that they've tended to lose money.
Yeah. If anything, I think maybe they go into the corner of their home and watch it alone, right? Like an addiction. I believe that you can give up Starbucks because sports, right? But I don't believe you can give up watching something you've loved your whole life.
I don't know, man.
Because of kneeling during the anthem.
Well,
I get being upset by that if you misunderstand why they're kneeling, but I just don't buy this claim that they're going to give up sports.
I'm skeptical about the number of people and the belief that it's widespread. People have stopped doing that. There's no doubt in my mind that people have turned it off. Like there are, and people that I know and that I've talked to, there's no doubt.
Turned it off, but still checking scores?
Maybe.
Still checking highlights?
But that would still be, well, no. I mean, if they're not watching, I mean, that's the lifeblood. The lifeblood of the NFL is people watching the live games on television. And I know of people who have not been interested in it anymore, in part because of it. My perception is that if that's over something that you believe is right, like if you're the league, why would you dictate and let your customers always tell you exactly when it's a matter of right and wrong? Because there's lots of things in the past of sports. But the idea that the NFL will always be king, I don't know if I'd go that far because I don't think that's necessarily true.
Did you watch the ESPYs last night?
I did not watch them, but I read a little bit about it this morning.
I mean, it was basically about sexual abuse, school shooting, rebuilding. I mean, it was empowering. I'm just wondering how people feel about that. It's when it doesn't highlight the performance of athletes, but some of the challenges they face.
You mean why some people might nickname it MS-ESPN?
Yeah.
Instead of MSNBC? I think it's great that they honored the victims of Larry Nassar's sexual abuse. They got the Arthur Ashe Courage Award.
Yeah.
But there are a group of people. It's funny. There's a segment of the media that talks about how much they want politics out of sports and social issues out of sports. And I find that those people talk about politics and social issues more because they keep talking about how they want it out of sports. So there's going to be a group of people that are turned off by that and want, just give me the scores. I just want to see the scores. It's different. You had Jim Kelly, who was honored for, he's been suffering from cancer.
Yeah.
And he received the Jimmy V Memorial Award and gave a very, very moving speech, which has kind of become a legacy there. Stuart Scott had given one. Jimmy Valvano, most notably, had given one. As you said, the coach of the year was one of the coaches who was killed in a school shooting down in Florida. No, yes. Is that right? Or was it Houston?
I think it was Florida. I think it was probably the Stoneman Douglas.
That's right. Telling that I'm not certain which school shooting it came from.
Yeah.
I just don't know how honoring survivors is in any way political. I mean, it makes the sports world more real. We learn the stories of these women. They are survivors. They are strong. They got their justice. And they're just saying, hey, next time 240 women come forward and say something, believe us.
You think there has been a sea change on that score?
On sexual harassment?
Yeah.
Yeah. I do. I certainly think across the country. You see, and I'm reading a story right now about photojournalism and having their own sort of Me Too moment with mm-hmm. several of the editors and prominent photographers who have engaged in serial harassment. Mm-hmm. I think there's an understanding of it. I think in the same way with political correctness, we're going to see if people start saying, oh, that means you can't say certain things without understanding the underlying rationale for that you can't do certain things. Oh, you can't do that anymore. And instead of it being because that's unfair and objectifying women and really just unprofessional and unbecoming, let alone potentially criminal, that you have, or is it just, oh, I just can't do that anymore?
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Choke points. Let's go. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The risky experiment of running fast ferry service from Kitsap County to Seattle is now 1 year old. The question is, has it been worth the investment? Chris Sullivan.
Well, you know, a narrow 51% of Kitsap County voters approved the 0.3% sales tax increase to fund the fast ferry passenger service in November of 2016. And service began July 10th of the following year. That was last year. $48 million in startup costs and about $11 million a year to operate. When fully operational, is a pretty big financial gamble for the county when we consider the financing over there. But the 30-minute trip between Bremerton and Seattle, that cuts half the time off of a regular Washington State ferry. And through the first year, it looks like Kitsap County commuters really like this option. More than 250,000 people have used this ferry in the first year. And considering that the boat only holds 118 people, that's a lot.
Yeah. So did I understand you correctly? You said a normal route would take an hour?
Yeah. The Bremerton to Seattle Washington State ferry takes an hour because you're loading all the cars. It takes an hour because they got to go super slow through the end. They've got restrictions.
They can't create wakes for the waterfront.
And so this one's a much smaller boat, much less footprint in the water, but so it can cruise and it does it in half the time. So all in all, people like it.
We're averaging about 98% capacity in the afternoon and 93% capacity on the sailings in the morning. So we're very pleased with how well it's been accepted.
That's Kitsap Transit Executive Director John Clausen. Now, he admits there were problems at the launch. I think we've all talked about that. More than 100 sailings were canceled in the first couple of months because there was a problem with the engine's ventilation system that they couldn't figure out, and they couldn't figure out. Finally, they got it repaired. There have been some dock and weather cancellations since, but reliability has gotten much better.
Once we discovered the primary cause of the mechanical issues, I think we've pretty much put that behind us now. So service delivery has been very, very reliable.
There are a couple of nagging issues with the reservation system that they're still kind of working mm-hmm. the kinks out of, but Clausen says, you know, they're on track to fix that. So service to Kingston and Seattle is supposed to start later this year. It was supposed to actually start this summer. They're a little behind. The boat that they had to bring over that they bought is currently being retrofitted. It should be ready by the end of September, and that's going to offer a 35-minute trip from Kingston to downtown Seattle.
Whoa.
When you consider that it's a 30-plus Washington State Ferry drive over now, and then you have to get on I-5 and deal with that, that's a pretty fast trip.
While we're working on the vessel, we have struck a lease agreement with the Port of Kingston, and the port is moving forward and actually have accomplished an awful lot to the refurbishment of the docking facilities itself in Kingston. So we're excited to get that service up and running.
I know a lot of golfers are as well, because you can catch a ferry from downtown Seattle Road right up there and play some of those courses off of Kingston.
Who pays for this?
Kitsap County.
They
passed a 0.3% sales tax increase on themselves. That's why I said it was kind of a risky proposition, and it passed pretty narrowly, and it was a pretty big gamble for them. Southworth service is expected to come to Seattle as well, based on this coming in 2020. And so far, Clausen's assessment of the first year, Kitsap County residents made the right choice, and the service is doing its job.
I'm very, very pleased with the way the service is operating. I'm excited about the participation by the community. You look at our Saturday ridership, for example. It's very strong. Obviously, our weekday ridership is strong.
So they're on their way. They're off and running, and they seem to have made a pretty decent choice here.
Given the success in other counties watching Kitsap County's success, is there talk about bringing this maybe south or further north?
You know, there has been talk a lot lately of, because we're at such capacity and overcapacity on our roads, is going back to using what God gave us, which is a lot of water.
That's how people used to get around.
You know, we talked about earlier this year, you know, maybe bringing back some sort of mosquito fleet across Lake Washington. I know there's one company in Renton that's looking about running a ferry service between Renton all the way to South Lake Union. Wow. So they're still working through how that might work and what it would cost.
Housing prices are substantially less in Kitsap County,
completely.
Right? So, I mean, if this really becomes a practical, viable, affordable commute alternative, that'd be a big deal for people looking for a good deal.
And that's why it's so attractive, because right now your options are you take that hour-long ferry ride for the state ferry, or you drive around Highway 16 and come back up through Tacoma, which can be a nightmare. Yeah. If you can make that trip, and they've tied it in with the bus service so well, because they can drop you off, you can use your car to get you from the bus to the ferry into downtown, and then you can zip with your Orca the rest of the way. You're right. A lot of people are looking to move that direction because it's cheaper to live there. If we have a viable way to get across, yeah, why not? So far, I mean, 250,000 people on a boat that's only 118 people big. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty successful.
Is that big enough, though, those fast food? I mean, that's the question. But, of course, a bigger one would take longer to load and get there.
You're right, and it might cause a bigger wake. And that's a super concern for the people trying to get through the inlets over there. We'll see. We'll see when we expand to Kingston here later this year how that works, how that's adopted, how people at the north end of the county like getting into Seattle that way. But I think it's an option that should be looked at. And again, only 51% passed. That was pretty narrow. There was a lot of concern over spending this kind of money on something like this. So far, seems to be working. But yeah, it's something that could be a template for other places. I know people in Olympia have talked about coming around the outside to tie into Tacoma with a boat. There's talk about this, using the waterways.
Where's the real benefit, though, other than to people who want to get to downtown Seattle or live out there and work in downtown Seattle? Because I haven't noticed over the last year any sort of road capacity decrease or anything like that.
Well, no, and that's the thing. This is a hyper-local way to get people from their area into Seattle.
It wasn't to ease congestion.
No, right? No. This was a way to give people another option other than taking a longer ferry ride or taking a much longer car trip or bus trip to get around. This was a hyper-local way, they thought, to try to ease for their particular county residents.
Cairo Radio's traffic coach, Chris Sullivan. Trump tweet, 6:11 a.m. Pacific, quote, "I told you so. The European Union just slapped a $5 billion fine on one of our great companies, Google." So let's bring in CBS's titan of tech, Larry Magid. Larry, what has gotten Google in trouble with the European Union?
Well, it's the same thing that got Microsoft in trouble with the U.S. and European officials literally 20 years ago, which is bundling. In this case, if you buy an Android phone, whether in Europe or the United States, it's going to have Google apps on it, including Chrome browser and including Google search. And the Europeans feel that that is a violation, an antitrust violation, because it makes it harder for competing search companies and browser companies to get people to use their product. So that's the essence of it. There's some other issues, but I think that's the main issue, not only on the fine, but the prohibition of them continuing this practice in the future unless Google happens to win on appeal.
Yeah, and I imagine their argument is the same as Microsoft's was. Nobody's stopping you from loading any other search engine you want to load.
And, you know, and I think that argument's even stronger in 2018 than it was in 1998, because, first of all, app stores are very easy to use. And second of all, people are more tech savvy. I'm sure there are some people who wouldn't know how or wouldn't bother. But the fact is that if you look at the iPhone, for example, it comes with Apple Maps. Yet almost every iPhone user I know uses Google Maps. So
right.
They've gone ahead and uploaded. So, and then the other argument here is one of the points that Bill Gates made in 1998 is, hey, you know, we may not be on top forever. Some entrepreneur may come out with a great product. Well, little did he know that a few months later, Larry Page and Sergey Brin would start Google. And little did Larry and Sergey know that 20 years later, they would be on the same hot seat that Bill Gates was on back in the late 90s. So, you know, that's my take. I think in this case, Donald Trump and I might actually agree on something, which would be unusual, but that could be.
Yeah. The other issue is Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and his mention of the Holocaust. I've read through this a couple of times. I'm trying to figure out what got him in trouble here. The issue is where for example, posts by Holocaust deniers would appear on a Facebook newsfeed? Is that what they're talking about?
Yeah. Well, here's the issue. There are two issues. First of all, what really got him in trouble is he said people are posting Holocaust denial unintentionally. And the Anti-Defamation League and many people said, no, that's not true. Holocaust denial is a deliberate anti-Semitic tactic. So that's what really got him into trouble. The broader issue is whether or not they should take it down. And that is something that I think is worthy of debate, because there are those who would argue that even though it's false, even though it's reprehensible, in America it is still permitted speech. Right. And, there could be a conversation around that, as bad as it is. So that is something that people can disagree on. And Facebook is struggling with it. Ironically, I'm actually at Facebook right now at a safety advisory board meeting. And these are the kinds of issues that we grapple with as advisors to them as to what they should do with controversial speech. So but you don't say that Holocaust, it's unintentional. This is deliberate anti-Semitism on behalf of the people who
I remember back when this first started coming up, there were people who reposted some of these things because the Holocaust denial is couched in like a fact check format, right? They bring up all these pieces of evidence and say, where's the evidence that this many people died, et cetera, et cetera. And so you might post that and say, hey, have you seen this? But I think now if somebody called me up on the phone and started denying the Holocaust, I can't blame the phone network for that, right?
Well, that's true. That is true. But if the head of the phone company then said, oh, by the way, they don't really mean it, it's not intentional, that's where Zuckerberg got in trouble. So that is a good point. On the other hand, the phone network, I mean, again, I can play both sides of this argument. The phone network couldn't have removed it in the same way that Facebook could.
Right.
So, for example, if somebody posted on the Cairo webpage, I don't know if you have a user forum, but if you did, and someone posted that, then your admins could make the decision as to whether they felt it was appropriate, and they might leave it up, they might take it down, and again, good people can argue about that, but they can't argue about the intention of the Holocaust.
Facebook clearly has the power to do this. They're a private company, but they're such a huge private company. At what point do they become a utility?
Well, you know, when you think about it, Mark Zuckerberg has more constituency than the U.S., China, and India combined, or very close to that number. And so you could almost argue they're almost like a government. But yes, there are people who think they should be regulated as a public utility. That's not going to happen. But there's certainly going to be some regulation, at least when it comes to election ads. I think that will happen and probably should, because the same regulations that radio, TV, and newsprint are under, that probably will happen.
By the way, on the upcoming election, the whole Trump summit controversy has again brought out these warnings. And they seem to be getting more and more dire, that all the what was one of the comments was the red lights are flashing again, our election is going to be attacked again. So what are they talking about there in Silicon Valley along those lines?
Well, I think that every company is talking about ways in which they can, first of all, demote fake news. They may not take it down, but they may demote it so it's seen by fewer people. Also, make sure that anybody who buys an ad is identified. They will not take ad dollars in rubles going forward, hopefully. But even when Americans buy ads, there'll be transparency as to who they are, and then better signals on the part of the social media companies to try to figure out when people are impersonating other people. So that's a lot of work that Mark Zuckerberg and his team have got to do.
So we'll see evidence of this on Facebook? I mean, would you see a warning saying that the person who sponsored this also bought time to sponsor this and that? Or what would you see?
Well, what you'll see is a profile of who they are, where the money came from. You know, on the radio ads, where I don't know if they do that in Washington State, but in California, they identify who it is that funded the ad.
Yes.
You'll see things like that, where you'll know it came from XYZ. So that'll be a start, but they've got a long way to go on that. Right.
So if it says this ad bought by Maria Butina, I know that I better take it with a grain of salt.
Then you know it's probably Russian money. Stay away.
Larry Magid, CBS Tech Analyst. Thank you, Larry. I appreciate it.
Thank you.